I am Dan Zafarek. This is Unfrozen.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And for today, I believe episode 87, well into our 80s, we're delighted to have our first novelist after all this time. Madeline Ashby is a lot more than just a novelist, but she is the author of the new book, Glass Houses, which concerns startups, emotional currency, technology, haunted houses. We'll get into it. Madeline, of course, is also a bona fide futurist, a friend that I've done work with in the past, and consults for a number of corporate clients around possible futures. Her previous books include the Machine Dynasty series and also Company Town, which again, getting back to corporate urbanism in some sense or another. But we're delighted to have Madeline on today to talk about the launch of her new book, which again, to me, if I had to explain it to you, the layperson, I would describe it as some sort of mashup of Lost, Ex Machina, and Glass Onion, in the sense of there is a plane crash, there is a mysterious tech CEO, and there is a high-tech house. So we can't wait to get into it. Madeline, welcome to Unfrozen.
Well, thank you for having me. That was lovely. But I feel a lot less nervous about the book coming out today now.
Well,
thank
there you.
You
go. Well, now that you've heard that my high concept Hollywood Robert Altman player style pitch,
right?
Let's kick off. How would you describe Glass Houses? And with a few weeks left of beach season, why is this the perfect page turner for the beach?
You probably hear my cat Hecate giving her own summary of the novel, but the best high concept descriptor that I heard from my own editor was it's like Black Mirror meets White Lotus, and which is the sort of very dark, very scary, very cynical, hard-edged view of not the technologies, but maybe the people who use them or the purposes to which they're used, combined with the sort of, you know, actually quite pleasant travelogue of White Lotus. One of the things I really like about the book is that the protagonist travels a great deal, and I finished and edited it during sort of more of the COVID lockdowns. And so there was this, I wrote it at a time when I really wished I could be traveling. So I like to think that it sort of sprinkled some pixie dust on those chapters in particular. It's Glass Houses is about a woman by the name of Kristen Howard, who is the chief emotional manager at a Toronto startup called WUV, W-U-V, which my agent at the time she's a New Zealander, and she didn't understand what that meant. Like, she'd never heard the word, because that's just not common over there. They speak actual English. And so I had to explain that. But she's the chief emotional manager at a company called WUV, and WUV makes emotional currency. They've kludged together some kind of, sensor technology and crypto and an app to create feelings as money. Which I think, like a lot of people who are hooked up to a lot of different kind of platforms would agree, is sort of a thing already. And this was the natural extension. And part of what took the book so long was that it took me a really long, long time to understand what the technology was going to be. The story I had, the story I basically knew. I knew how it was going to end. I knew who the protagonist was. I knew a lot of different things about the story, but it really wouldn't work. Like, the central metaphor of the book, like, would not work unless I had the technology in place. And it took a very long time for me to like land on the right thing or the right way of expressing it. And the way that I knew that it had worked was that I was talking about it with my friend Carl Schrader, who's also a graduate of the Strategic Foresight and Innovation Program at OKEDU, and also a member of the Writers Workshop that I was a member of for a long time. When I pitched the idea of the technology to him, there was just this tiny little scared look that he gave me, like this like, oh, like, and he actually said, "That's evil." And I was like, "Yes, we have a book."
couple of points. One, we'll put into the show notes that there is an earlier short story starring Kristen in this, and what I think of as like the emblematic Madeline Ashby theme, which is inevitably a piece of smart urban technology. It's a smart home. It's a autonomous Uber. How the combination of the built environment and technology is put together to abuse someone. There is a person in it who's being abused, and that your protagonist, Kristen in particular, inevitably finds a way to hack said urban built environment to take revenge upon the abuser. And I think you capture in these particular works that strain that runs through Philip K. Dick and others about, you know, the fact that any smart technology eventually becomes a haunted technology or a hack technology. And so I guess I want to start to bring this back to architecture and urbanism. Can you talk a bit about, you know, the centerpiece of glass houses, the monolithic black house, which is really a core representation of the haunted house as a smart technologically enabled house? What inspires you architecturally in when you write about these things? And what is it about smart home technology in particular? Delving into the perverseness of how these technologies are weaponized against vulnerable people is both the core work of your foresight and of your fiction. So we'd love to hear more about the inspiration of this and how it plays out in the novel.
I think, like, I've always loved haunted house stories generally. Like, one of my favorite films of all time is The Old Dark House, which is James Whale's, I think, 1931 picture, also with Boris Karloff, but also with, like, Melvin Douglas, and I think it's Melvin Douglas, I might be wrong, and a bunch of others, and it's hysterically funny. It really has these, like, it's a horror comedy, and like Charles Laughton's in it. It's absolutely hysterically funny, but it's a haunted house story about, like, it's very, very gothic. I've always loved stories like that. Even from when I was a kid, I'm married to a horror writer. I read The Shining when I was like 11 years old and got in trouble for bringing it to school at one point. I've always loved that kind of story, and the connection between, like, hauntedness and that which is sort of inhabited by a technological persona or a built persona or artificial intelligence or like a persona of some type is fairly obvious. Like, even, I think it was about 10 years ago, actually maybe longer, I did an event with the Institute for the Future as part of an anthology that I was in with them, and, like, Bruce Sterling was in it, and a bunch of others, like Rima Islam, and I think Cory Doctorow as well. Like, and we had all, the theme of the anthology was the coming age of networked matter, and you can go find it, like, the stories are out there, the anthologies are out there, and almost, like, down to the last person, we had all somehow cohered on this idea of those of a haunted house story or haunted object story, and stuff. And, you know, I even listened to, like, the Haunted Objects podcast with Greg and Dana Newkirk, and one of their central arguments is that, like, these objects may not in fact be, like, haunted as we think of them. What they are haunted by is, like, our impressions, our wishes, our, you know, our desires, and the emotional valences that we bring to those things. And I think that's basically, like, pretty true, especially when you're talking about impressing your wishes on a quote-unquote smart object or home. And I think I've always sort of been fascinated with that intersection. I did, like, a master's degree in cyborg theory, and sort of that gets into where that line between programming and wishing or wish casting sort of comes into play. And also, I think, like, I was raised by a dad who did surveillance for a living. So, like, I was always aware of, we would go, every time we went out or we went shopping or got gas or whatever, like, he would point out, like, which cameras were real and which weren't, and where they were hidden, and where they would be looking, as opposed to where you thought they were looking. And so it was just sort of something that was always in my mind, or that was always on my mind. And so when I decided to do this big house on an island, there were a lot of different drafts of the house. I looked at a lot of different examples of that kind of architecture. I had used to, once upon a time, I used to write copy for a luxury real estate brand. So I really knew like what should be there. And then finally, like I landed close to when the book was done, or close to the final draft, I landed on, oh wait, it should just be a black box. It should just be a black box, and things go in and they don't come out.
So I have a question about then the other architecture protagonists or antagonists in the book then. I'm going to try to avoid asking any questions that would lead to spoilers of plot, but there is another sort of important character in the book who is first discovered at another house, which is in Los Angeles in the Mulholland Drive, Hollywood Hills area. And that house is described quite interestingly as a sort of, you know, a series of offset cubes. And I used to live in LA. It's very easy for me to picture that. So what is the significance of the difference between that house and the let's call it the evil house or the main house on the island that is a kind of an obsidian cube that just sort of is like a black hole? Whereas this has a slightly different story. It's still weird. There's still stuff going on there that's not normal. But maybe you can describe that house and how that you were inspired by that.
I think, like, I had... You know, I'm a huge fan of Michael Mann. I will watch Heat any day of the week, sometimes twice in a day. Like, I really, like, when I realized that there were, like, Michael Mann, that there was Michael Mann Blue on the cover of the book, and when I realized that it was essentially the same colors, although sort of reversed in proportion to the poster for Manhunter, which is one of my favorite films of all time, like, when I realized that, I kind of died, and I think I even like got in touch with Zoe Van Dyke, who did the cover, which is amazing, and said like, oh my god, it's the Manhunter colors. And what was great was that she got it. She knew exactly what I was talking about. I was born in LA. I was born in Los Angeles, and I love LA, and I'm going to be there at the end of this week, which I'm really looking forward to, and I've done LA architecture tours and stuff like that, and I actually really love the history of sort of Hollywood homes, like the history of architecture there that was built around Hollywood and so on. So I'm really enamored of that. I'm also really enamored of the fact that the big glass box house usually means somebody is very evil in a lot of cinema. Whether it's the house in, there's a house in Heat that is like this, where William Fichtner's, character lives, and also the house in, Fincher's Dragon Tattoo, where it's all glass and you can see all the way through and yet you don't know anything that's going on in there and no one does. And that transparency and the transparency as a lie, or aggressive transparency, or obfuscating transparency and opacity, I found really fascinating, and I think is a pretty good metaphor for like a lot of different business practices generally. And so in the house in LA, the house on Mulholland Drive, that's sort of in the hills, is a house where that is a series of sort of cubes or long, almost container sized things of glass stacked on each other at odd sort of like Brasilia metabolist Tokyo angles. I'm a big fan of Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, and there's like a whole episode that takes place in like a metabolist Brasilia tower. I became more of a fan of brutalism after I moved to Toronto, because there's a great deal of like really lovely brutalist architecture here. That you'll know it if you've seen a lot of Cronenberg movies, because that's where they're all made. but this house in particular, the house that is in California, is alive in a really specific way, in that like the moment that you look at one of the glass panels, they frost over. There's a pretty basic like eye saccading or like sort of eye focus detection algorithm that's at play. And the moment that you look at into one of the walls, that's gone. And it also has a different, like, I think like the lawn is printed in a, like a dazzle pattern so that it doesn't read on satellite or whatever. And there's just like various little ambient security things that I really like because they're very low tech, like they're very unobtrusive. And I think that's kind of the thing that, if I'm thinking about my own design preferences, that's usually what I tend to prefer is like a, what is the minimum viable technology that gets this done? And what is the thing that will sort of blend into the surrounding environment in the best possible way?
Maybe talk a little bit about the furniture in the glass house, because there's like very specific description that it's like a very specific description of blandness.
Yes. That like the, I've done, you know, I think everybody, when I shop for locations, because I do this a lot, like, I'll look at locations, you see a lot of, like, very bland, like, architecture, but really, like, having gone through my share of hotel lobbies, I just designed it to look like a sort of ersatz design hotel. Like, I take a lot of photos in hotel lobbies, I've worked retail in the past, so I know that they like basically have an obligation to make money per square foot, much like retail spaces. So it's always really interesting to me, like what a lobby is designed for. Is it like a co-working space? Is it a clubbing space? Is it a place where you go drink? Is it a place where blah, 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 like all those different things. So between like science fiction conventions and consulting work and so on, you see a lot of these spaces and you see a lot of their commonalities. And so it was very easy past a certain point to just sort of imagine the very deliberate placelessness. I think it's, is it Toshiya Ueno? I think it's Toshiya Ueno who has the idea of cultural odorlessness. When you want to look very, when you want a space to look very cultured and that culture is Pier 1 and, or Cosplus or something like that, where it's like, yeah, no, it was all made in the same place. It was, you know, it was probably all made on a container ship somewhere, like, you know, that kind of thing. So I get very, it was very easy to describe once I thought about it.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And it also makes it more mysterious in a way, because it's the house is, while it's behaves in suspicious ways and has all these kind of, you know, tricks that you have to figure out, when you get inside, mm-hmm. you're kind of like, this is the evil person's lair. It looks like Cosplus.
Yeah, you're sort of like, this is
like,
you know.
Like, of course it does.
Yeah, no, it's the, you know, when you look at fascist art, it is often incredibly bland because anything else would make you feel something or draw you into an experience of empathy. And of course we can't have that. So it has to be the blandest thing. It has to be pablum. It has to be easy going down. It has to be digestible. It has to make you not pay attention to it. I'm a big fan of Nine Inch Nails, and I really, really like the work that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did on a Halsey record a couple years ago that she put out, and called If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power. And in the interviews they did around the release of the thing, he said that we really liked what she sent us, like the four demo tracks or whatever that she sent us, but the way they had been produced, because that's what he and Ross did, the way that they had been produced was to encourage the audience not to listen to them or not to pay attention to them because they sounded like everything else. And so I think that there's like a little bit of that. But
now this I have
taste
to hear.
Or, yeah, it's just such a great record. It's so
well,
fun.
You know,
it's a really
the
fun
principle
record.
Of Unfrozen is that it's the reaction to the Goethe quote, probably apocryphal, that architecture is frozen mm-hmm. music. So the idea is that we're sort of trying to demystify architectural conversations by way of inserting a lot of popular metaphors from popular music.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard this tune, so I'm going to have to do this.
Yeah, no, it's a really great record, and it's a really lovely, like, I really like the record, and you can hear it right away, like the difference in the music and in her music in particular. It just and it does force you to kind of like continue paying attention. And I think that's what good design, like there's an idea that good design is sort of invisible, and for the most part, I think that's true. When you're doing art, though, like when you're not designing to be invisible, when your arts practice is to be noticed, it's gonna re like you're going to put a different layer on those things that is sort of more pay attention to me.
Well, this is an obvious setup to diverge from the book for just a moment, then, to
Sure.
ask your opinions as both a novelist and a futurist about your sort of thoughts on generative AI slop, as we've started calling it, and the aesthetics of AI as the sort of, sum total of averageness. That's the way I like to think about GAI. If you're training something on the collected scraping of the web, how can you ever achieve more than simply the average of the web? But I'm curious your thoughts on the aesthetics of that, though, what comes out of it. Because it is, I mean, to me, it's obvious what's an AI-generated image. It has a sort of uncanny blandness to it in the way you're describing it there, too. But yeah.
It ha like I think yeah, I mean I think that it's possible that that might shift or that the models might shrink or something like that. That's obviously like entirely possible. Because it's a series of step functions. Everyone who's gone to a boring party has performed step functions. That's what talking about the weather is. The one, I think that like if you're using this stuff, you're cheaping out, you're basically telling your artist friends that they mean nothing to you. Don't be surprised if they don't talk to you anymore. The other is, you're anything that's trained on the internet, anything that is trained on the internet, is always going to reflect the internet in proportion, right? Everything that it's going to sort of regenerate everything that it saw in proportion, unless told otherwise. So at its baseline, it's always just going to like replicate what it saw, which is why it all looks like porn. It just looks like porn. Like it just looks like porn, and it looks like really boring porn, like not even interesting porn. Like it looks like, the porn that you would like gateway porn. And so it looks like a lot of hentai, it looks like a lot of sort of loosely animated stuff. Like it looks like a lot of things that, was sort of again sort of kludged together by some poor bastard sleeping under his desk, in who's never seen the light of day and or hasn't in a long time. And I think that's sort of what it ends up looking like, is it like it just ends up looking like porn. Because that's, like if you did the sort of iceberg analysis, the core sampling of what the internet was made of, like there's like that, cats, and and a few other things, but mostly porn, because that was what was there first. That and hey, did we let those nukes loose? And so there's, I think that's what it ends up looking like, and it and so therefore it always ends up like looking very narrow, and not interesting, and very, I guess like very bland. Like there was a moment when I could tell that. I was seeing a photo that like was going around that had been generated, and this was like a year or two ago, and I could tell that it had just been trained on like every Pinterest and Instagram engagement photo shot ever taken, because of the outfit that the woman was wearing and the fact that her hand could only go like this, because it had been trained on hand models that were, you could tell that the hands, that they had focused really intensely on the hands to improve them and like not have six fingers or whatever. But you could also tell that they were reversed, that the hands had been reversed, or that the most common expression of the hand was this, was showing off wedding rings, right? And so because of the positioning of the hand, like it's a position that you never hold your hand in. No one holds their hand that way unless they're doing this. And so it was it's telling what comes through. It's its own little artifact, what comes through.
Some of the other things that you touch on in the in the in the book are not really about architecture or even so much about technology, but they are about place and they're about sort of critical differences across our shared border. And the way that those specific communities think about technology and about, well, how people should behave towards one another. I would say I'm talking to two people north of the border, one of whom is an American refugee, one of whom is a Canadian. It's a little rough on the Americans, particularly the Californians. I noted with some glee that two of the main characters are named after streets in San Francisco. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. There's probably more than I'm aware of, but
there are hidden jokes in the Canadian names.
Hidden
jokes in the Canadian names, and then there are hidden, like, calling one person Sumter was like a very deliberate, like that had to be that name, and it was not going to be anything else. I think I ended up changing the names on a bunch of people, but that was the one that like really. I had his name from the beginning, and then Kristen. I knew that Kristen's name was Kristen, and stuff. I didn't, other stuff, like, it took me a long time to place her last name, whatever, but there is definitely, like, I'm an American living in Canada, I'm now a Canadian citizen, and I came here in 2006, so I've seen a lot of different changes in that relationship, and I've worked with people who monitor that relationship and, you know, especially with, you know, the closing of the border during the COVID lockdown and stuff, there were people who told me, like, I never thought I would see this happen. I'm like, just you wait. The book takes place in a future wherein, for some reason, a lot of Americans start sending their students, whether university or sort of boarding school age, over the border into Canada. They just start sending their kids to school there for no particular reason that is ever specified. They just start doing it. And there becomes like these sort of like enclaves of Americans, like, who are building their own sort of little startup economies in along that border, which in fact is true. I mean, like, that's, you know, the Americans find each other here and so on. So the majority of Americans who live in Canada live within the border by like a couple of hours. So it wasn't unlikely to me that something like that might happen or that these groups would sort of come together. It's also sort of part of Canadian tech policy is that, like, they want to encourage a lot of investment. Like, there's a huge amount of, like, AI startups and, like, AI labs here because they get to work in a place that is like America but isn't. And for a long time, especially under in the Trump administration, it became very friendly for tech developers to bring foreign workers into Canada because they could bring their whole family. They could bring families as opposed to not being able to bring families necessarily. And even, God, like, I think I was in Menlo Park in 2018, actually when that story came out in Slate called Domestic Violence. And on the way, I think it was on the way out from the airport, on your drive out the airport, from SFO, there was like a thing that there was a big billboard from the Canadian government saying, like, you know, did you strike out here? Why have you thought of, like, essentially, have you considered Canada? It's like the what is the title of Sam B's book? It's excuse me, do you have a moment to think about, excuse me, do you have a moment to talk about Canada? Like, it was like that. It was basically like that and stuff. And it was for these people who, you know, like, wanted something different and stuff. So, and by and large, I think it's worked. Like, the startup visa, like, they filled their quota of applicants, like, within hours or something like that. It was, like, really crazy.
Well, all right, so post-pandemic, obviously, with the whole rise of remote work, there was always like a startup aesthetic. So I would love to hear your thoughts on this as well in terms of like the office aesthetic and what it means to be part of technology culture. Like you're obviously describing WOV and like sort of the toxic culture of the Valley. Like how would you describe that now in the sort of post-AI, post-remote work, like post, rise of, the fascist tech bros? I don't know. I guess I'm curious like about your thoughts on the evolution of tech culture and what that means as an architectural aesthetic. Given that some of them are sort of, renouncing, we see trends like network states and renouncing like urbanity and architecture in general for this. I'm curious how you're weaving that together in current work or also in your futures work as well, and sort of thinking about like what does technology as a culture mean as software ate the world and then trying to embed it further. And I think that's because, all right, so background for our listeners as well. So I have commissioned Madeline to do some work for my final project for Cornell Tech, which we were once calling the Metaverse Metropolis until that word got too toxically irradiated by Mark Zuckerberg. So the augmented cities we're calling it, Madeline's taking some of the findings out of the workshops that we did and creating these visions of the future. And I think about this, the reason it's important to me is because, having conquered our immaterial lives and our love lives and our dream lives and our emotional lives, they're coming for the physical world next and have been for years with the Internet of Things and all these things. So I guess I'm curious about your potential trajectories, work you've done in this, or where you think it goes as Silicon Valley tries to colonize like the city itself.
I think that's really interesting because I think, yeah, you're right that like there's a desire to sort of get inside every relationship. I think like that's what's really been the gesture of technology has been like, how can we monetize every relationship you have? And if you stop having human relationships, can we monetize a relationship with an AI? And then can we monetize a relationship between you and your coffee maker or your bed? Or like things in your home.
If I could pause there for one second, it's interesting
Sure.
that both simultaneously the decline of the dating apps, which is now in full swing, that bubble is bursting and we're seeing a massive drop off. And then you have, of course, the rise of AI boyfriends and girlfriends, and someone has just launched a social network in which you are guaranteed that every other person on the network besides you is an AI bot. And the way they get around this is like you'll be more inclined to use it if you're not suspicious of their bots. They're just bots. And I love it because it's like finally stripping away every last illusion. This is about anything other than the dopamine hit of some bit of code being like, "You're awesome. That's so great. I loved your post on this." So you're right. This like massive fracking of human consciousness and monetization continues. But anyway, I'll stop you there. But I wanted to flag that for listeners because like that stuff is so pernicious.
No, I think it is. I think you're right. It's extremely pernicious, and it is about sort of about how the brain works and how we now understand like so much more about like how our sort of dopamine cycles work and how our risk reward systems work and intermittent reward and addiction and so on and so forth. And even down to like now there's talk about prescribing GLP-1s to for like addiction and mood disorders because it gets it inter it interrupts the satiety cycle, right? And those hormones, which really that's what it is. It's not anything else. I think we know more, and that knowledge can be used against us. It can be leveraged against us easily. But I think also you're getting into like ex the closer you get to that stuff, the more you interrupt those cycles, the closer you're getting to like very primitive drives, like the idea of a social network that is populated solely by bots who tell you how great you are is like, it's like the Bumble CEO or or director who said that, eventually we're just gonna you're gonna have like your digital twin or your agent sort of find other agents for you, and then your people will literally call their people and so on and put you together. And it's like, yeah, I remember meeting boys that way. It was called playing Barbies. And it's literally that. It's like literally like smashing your Barbie and his G.I. Joe together, and pretending you know what's going on. The which I'm like could work. I'm not saying it couldn't work. Again, it's worked for years before. But I think that you're getting into a place where eventually I think like the goal of most technology is to make you entirely dependent on it. Like ra it's like a it. It is I think that is where it lines up with the sort of abuse dynamics that we were talking about before, right? That it's that there's a lot of Darvo sort of deny, you know, deny, reverse, gaslight, whatever, built into a lot of technologies, mostly because they isolate you from networks of support. They can connect you with networks of support, but if the network of support to which you are connected or which you have developed is then leveraged against you or made to cost more or what have you, how supportive was it really? How supportive was it ever? Have you been sort of, you know, gaslit by this thing, or have you been manipulated, or, you know, is this thing your frenemy and not your friend? And, you know, I think like yesterday I was just seeing a lot of people who are Patreon creators who were saying that if their patrons are following them through the app on their iOS device, they are now getting, like, those subscriptions now cost the individual creator 30% more than they did before, or 30% of the cost, which they didn't. And apparently this is sort of endemic to the Apple landscape, that, and the iOS landscape in particular, that, you know, if you are subscribing to something, it, more of it comes out of the creator's pocket. So of course, like, the store looks great, but it's coming out of somebody, that's because it's coming out of somebody else's pocket. And that's a, to me, a very classic instance of, like, I have become dependent on a thing. The technology enabled my dependence on it, in a way that was beneficial, or that is beneficial and continues to be beneficial, but the cost of that benefit is always increasing in a way that that previously individuals were never called upon to bear. And that, I think, is, like, also the real crucial thing, because it's, you know, I'm not saying, oh, all technology is bad, blah, blah, blah. No. I need a lot of things to live my best life. I'm not denying the use of tools. What I do think is important to recognize, though, is, like, when those things are shunting an unfair burden on an individual that used to be shared by a collective, and that used to be shared by an authority or an agency or, like, an organization who had clear standards and was legally liable for upholding them. And that is no longer the case. Like, when you fritter out that responsibility onto the individual, when you offload that onto the individual or sort of download it onto them, you're creating, you know, more cognitive load, you're creating more cortisol in their body, probably. You're essentially, like, creating, which is to say, you're creating inflammatory disease 20 years later that you can then, you know, retail a product for that too, right? So I think that there's, that I think is where I start to get a little bit suspicious.
So I have a total, I don't know, softball speculative question for you. This is something that we tend to do when we get an author on board who's talking about a particular brand of architecture or societal condition that involves a few, seen through the eyes of a few characters, right, or a few key players. Have you thought at all about, it, would this become a movie? And if it were, do you have, who would you cast?
I think I named Kristen even after, like, a mishmash of, like, Kristen Bell and Kristen Stewart, because I was a huge fan of Veronica Mars, and Kristen Howard is very similar to the Veronica Mars character. But I also just really love Kristen Stewart. Like, you know, like, I think that she got a really rough shake throughout a lot of things. And I just, you know, she has, like, a really specific look that when I think about Kristen, like, she kind of, like, looks like her in my head. Mostly because I am not, like, very gamine at all. Like, I try to cast people in my head who don't look like me at all. And also, like, I had wanted to do, like, as a person who had once been a child watching a lot of Hitchcock movies when they had pneumonia at, like, the age of five, I really just wanted one novel that was about, like, a Hitchcock blonde. And so I, you know, put her in there. There were a lot of different guys who I cast for her, for the people around her, for the guy that she meets in LA. And he's gone back and forth. Like, there are a lot of different guys. I'd have to pull up the document actually to pull up the entire list. So I can't recall the person that I settled on either. But yeah, I've thought about it a lot, and I've thought about how it would look and like sort of, you know, how I would shoot it. Like, I think I tend to think in those terms anyway. Like, you know, what is it that the camera should see? What is it that the, you know, how does somebody do this? And I even block out scenes kind of that way. Like, though I write my sentences and I write my dialogue so that there's enough breath stops in the sentence that I can read them, but also so an actor can read them. Like, I tend to like block and stop my speeches so that when I'm reading something out loud, I read it the way I sort of mark my speeches the way that you would mark a script, and have that sense about it that like the sentence is very pretty. Can you read it out loud? Is usually the sort of the mark for me. So I do tend to think about like how it would look on film, or like how it would be designed, how it would be, like what it would look like, what the various color tones would be, like how you would color code every place in it, blah blah blah, that stuff. Yeah, sure.
So if a director comes on board, you're going to have some notes.
Oh, I mean, like I would answer any question honestly, but like also the book that lives in your head, like the Evangelion answer to this question is that the book that lives in your head is different from the one that lives in mine. And the movie that lives in your head is different from the movie that lives in mine. And so, yeah, could I, you know, give a lot of notes and make a lot of demands? One, I probably couldn't make a lot of demands, and I think my film agent would be angry if I did. But two, I think the thing that I would want actually is someone who would allow me into the process to observe it. Like most projects that I do, I tend to do so that I can learn. I did an audio drama with Realm Media that was a continuation of the Orphan Black series, and that was where I learned how to do sort of traditional writer's room story breaking. I had not learned how to do that before, and no other experience really, short of doing that job, would have taught me that process. And it was hugely valuable because I had not been an outliner until that point. I had been a pantser and not a plotter in the parlance of our times. So I really benefited from a process wherein I was responsible for this chunk of the plot and had to hand the baton on to other people. And those types of experiences, I think if I were involved in some kind of adaptation, I would just sort of be like, can I just hang out? Can I just watch this happen? That would be the most beneficial to me.
So, Madeline, thank you for letting us hang out with you today. This has been extraordinary. The book Glass Houses is a total page turner. It's very well paced. It almost, yeah, I couldn't put it down. I mean, and I don't say that very often about books that I'm reading, partially because I read a lot of nonfiction that is rather wonky, but it's in another class. So.
I will tell you, it was really humbling. The book is, every time I cut the book down, it got better. And it's a really humbling realization. I think a lot of writers and creators of all stripe kind of go through this when you realize that like the thing will improve the less of it there is something no one wants to hear ever. And yet it is almost always true. Which I guess is my, you know, less is more. Take off the last thing you put on, kind of a design wisdom.
Jermaine, going back to the AI slop there, we know when you have machines that can produce infinite amounts of tokens, like it just simply underscores how useless most of those tokens are. So, well, thanks again for joining us, Madeline. That's been Unfrozen episode 87. We'll be back soon with a new one. Take care.
Thank you.